One.
What's up, everyone? We have a really great episode of the show today. We have a special guest, Anthony D'Ambrosio. Everyone, thank you, Anthony, for being here.
All right.
I hadn't planned on it, no.
Plan on it.
Dude, I'm really excited about this episode.
Minus five, four, three, two, one. Booster ignition and liftoff.
Kyle, are we,
You're gonna die.
You're good.
I'm Raina DeRoyo. We'll see you next time.
I'm gonna put it on my shot.
Yeah, come on. So, Kyle, before we start, I just want to make a little announcement that this week's episode of the show is brought to you by... Hey, throw me up there.
All right.
This week's episode of the show is brought to you by Drink Studio Coffee. Studio Coffee. Kyle, do you drink a lot of coffee?
You know, I've always said that I've never had a cup of coffee in my life. That's a rock hard, stone cold fact.
Really?
But if I ever did... it would be Studio Coffee.
Now, you're on the... can you share about your ADHD? You're on the...
Yeah, no, I don't need coffee because I'm actually on Adderall nowadays.
Okay.
And, you know, what is coffee if not the poor man's Adderall?
That's true. That's true. So what's that experience been like? Do you feel more productive?
I mean, yeah, I do feel more productive. I also have a lower appetite, so I do project myself losing weight in the near future, which I'm pretty pumped for. Some people think of it as like a negative thing, you know, decreased appetite, but I think it's a real win in my life.
Cool. All right, man. Well, Anthony, thanks for being here. You got your mic right here.
Yeah.
Thanks for being here. How have things been?
Popped a button there.
So you're in, where do you live now? Denver.
Denver, now. Catholic Mecca. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah,
is it good there?
It's, you know, the cold showers there are especially awesome.
Oh, you've been taking cold showers?
Yeah, I mean, that's the way, man. Just do for the dopamine.
Wait, Kyle, did you ever do this before where you took cold showers?
I did it for Lent one time when I was in high school, but my mom actually made me quit the cold showers because I was smelling really bad because I wasn't really scrubbing very well.
Mm.
So that was tough.
Yeah, I did one Lent. I actually did, I don't know if I've told you this story yet, Anthony, but like one Lent, I tried doing the cold shower thing. I got pretty deep into it. But then I realized you're supposed to do the entire shower cold. Do you do the whole shower cold, Kyle, or just like the ending? Because my friend Nick told me that I was a fake because I wasn't doing the entire shower cold.
Yeah, doing the end cold, that's like a James Bond thing. Like Sean Connery would do that in like the Bond movies. I was trying to do the whole thing.
Wait, why would he do that in the Bond movies?
It's like a thing. It like wakes your body up and you can just like see him in some of, you know, it's the Bond movies. They have these shower scenes and he's like turning it cold right at the end.
Just to wake yourself up?
It's like it wakes you up. It like gets you ready. It's like the softer version. But I think it's still like a version. But if you're doing like Exodus, you got to do the whole thing.
Okay, and then what's the worst thing you've ever done for Lent?
Dude, the cold shower thing was tough. When I was in college, I also gave up making out with my girlfriend one time. That was pretty funny.
Wait, what?
Yeah, we kissed one time a day. That was like the idea.
I think you're just supposed to give up making out with your girlfriend in general.
Yeah, I know, but you know, I was trying to do it for Lent. Giving up a sin for Lent's always kind of weird, but you do what you can.
It's important.
Yeah. Well, enough of all that crap. Mm-hmm. Anthony, here we are. You have a lot of big things going on in your life.
Single.
Yeah, I meant projects, but yeah. I don't know which one. I'm really excited to talk about the film. So maybe we talk about the book and the subscription first.
Okay.
So you launched a children's book.
I did launch a children's book.
Okay.
I wrote a children's book called Beakle and the Star Stone, which is a playful retelling of the parable of the pearl of great price or the buried treasure.
Yeah.
But with birds on a jungle island. Yeah.
Not to be confused with The Pearl by Steinbeck. Did Steinbeck write The Pearl?
Yeah, this is a little more adapted for bedtime.
For children. Yeah.
How did you come up with the name Beakle? I think the name Beakle is very fun.
Oh, it's a really, I mean, it's a great name for a boy bird, don't you think?
I completely agree.
Yeah, Kyle, what the crap?
I said, how'd he come up with it? Because I liked it. It was a compliment.
Dude, I'm not liking your tone today, Kyle. Yeah. Anyways, so for people that don't, just quick history of you. I think a lot of people know you who watch my show, but like quick history of agency. Just like give me the trajectory up until like we should write and launch a children's book.
Yeah. So I was doing youth ministry and was, as one does, getting burnt out and wondering what was next. We connected. We came together and we made Catholic Creatives happen, launched that off, and then ended up managing that while running a creative firm that really used storytelling and branding to build, help communities that were trying to build really deep spiritual kind of movements, help them to launch. So that was kind of the bread and butter. And while we were doing that, we were working with lots and lots of churches. And as you know, it can be a little bit, I don't want to say, can I say soul crushing?
You can say whatever you want.
Yeah, it can be a little soul crushing, waiting in there and lots of, you know, lots of diocesan kind of conversations that go something to the tune of like, do you have insurance for this or like whatever. So anyway, while we're doing that, we decided that as a team, we wanted to do something much more fun that was more direct to
consumer.
Like families, yeah, you know, yeah. Just like, I mean, direct to consumer, but it's like at the
direct
end of the day,
people, direct to people.
Yeah. At the end of the day, like what we're trying to do in helping the church is to help ultimately families to be stronger.
Yeah.
And so, being able to like, hey, we're going to help a family directly through making this amazing, magnificent, like playful bedtime experience for families to have. And we're like, we're going to design a children's book, but we're going to like UX this, you know, we're going to come up with all of the ways that we could make this like particularly impactful, as a, almost like a script for bedtime. So
did your family read, like, did you get read stories growing up?
Yeah, I did. Very, we did, but here's the problem that I found in my family was that as soon as there was more than, I'm from a family of five, and as soon as there was more than like two kids, you know, my brother and I and our sister, there was too much of a spread
in
for
the age.
All of us to
enjoy
the same story. So then like the little kids would get, you know, something that was rather boring, and the older kids would kind of run off to their rooms and read their own stuff. And I wanted to come up with a way that would like preserve that familial bedtime experience for much longer, that could embrace both younger kids, but that also had that sort of story, complexity that brings older kids to the table and gives them a real moral that they can, kind of eat.
Yeah. I have that same problem with movies. 'Cause like my youngest is four, the oldest is 10. It's like, I guess we're all just going to watch Avengers, and my 4-year old is going to watch Loki get strangled.
Yeah.
Like it's just going to happen.
It's just going
to
happen.
It makes me a bad parent. Mm-hmm. Do you have children's books that stand out to you that you really like? There, and I'll go first. Thanks for asking.
Yeah, you got it.
The Weight of a Mass is a really fantastic one.
It's a really good one.
But do you have other ones where you're like, oh, this is like what I'm aiming for, something like that, or just that influenced you?
Actually, The Little Prince was one that really influenced me because it's obviously written for kids, but it's got this incredibly playful thing throughout, and it's a chapter book. So it's this book in a way that's really written for adults, but that children also can grasp onto. It's super universal.
Yeah.
And I was really trying to hit something like that when I wrote Beagle.
That's a good one. Kyle, did your parents read you books growing up? Or, read you stories or bedtime stories? Or?
Yeah, they did. And for me, it was Where the Wild Things Are. Something book. And I've read it to my nephew a bunch of times. And it's just something so fantastical about the world they created that I think is really cool. And I think it holds up well.
I've thought about this a lot. I always have like a very, like the act of an adult, or the act of a person holding up a book and reading, and like the pauses and this sounds really weird, but like almost like the ASMR of like an adult like flipping the page and stuff. I don't know why, but that's always been like really satisfying. Even when I'm doing it to my kids, like there's something about like the pausing, the turning, and like the whole experience that's really cool. Anyways, I just thought I'd share that.
Yeah, like one of the things that I did was we put a QR code on the back that you can use to turn on like jungle noises.
Oh, that's cool.
While you're like reading. So things like that make something an immersive experience. It's like this really puts you like many dad points above the rest when you're reading to your kids and putting in that extra energy to make it immersive.
Yeah.
And making questions and answers and little like back and forths that are written into the book. Those things I think help a lot to make a bedtime reading experience feel like it's a, you know, a loving connection between the reader and the children. So we decided to write all of that in to make it easier.
And who wrote it? Like
the story? I wrote it. Yeah, I wrote it. And then, we all kind of edited it and illustrated it together. Yeah.
And then you workshopped it too. 'Cause I remember you were looking for people to, like to almost have a focus group on it.
Yeah.
What was that experience like?
It was really fun. Beta testing children's books is really like, it's the children are like the best beta testers.
Yeah.
Ever, you know what I mean? They just like, you know exactly when they lose their attention and like all of that. I think it's actually really great. Like if I could recommend anything to priests, it would be like if kids are being squirmy during your homilies, like they're just the ones that are being honest, you know? So watch them. And if you've got them, then you're good. And if you don't have them, then like you need to change the
way. Were there any significant edits that happened? Like,
Really? Yeah. Yeah. Totally. Yeah. I mean, one was like, we just had to cut out many, many pages.
Okay.
We had to really compress it down. And, that's always part of like the process of editing.
That's great. I wonder how many books get focus tested like that or like products.
I don't think many. Yeah,
because like when you think
products for sure, but not books.
Because when you think of because that's crazy. Because if you think about what you would have published had you not done the focus group, there's like substantial changes.
Yeah,
that's wild to think about. Man, now I'm thinking like, what other things? Because like when I think of a focus group, I think normally I just think like, oh, that's what like Coca-Cola does or something.
Right. Yeah.
Was there like a scientific approach to it, or was it more just intuitive? Like, I read it. I know where the beats were that need to change kind of thing.
Yeah. There wasn't necessarily something scientific about it. We did multiple, but each one was, there's a very clear intuitive, like here's the places where kids are getting squirmy or, like if we want this to really be usable for bedtime, like it's got to move more quickly and for parent to make it easier for parents to use. And all of the chapters have to be pretty much like exactly the same proportionally. So things like that, that we were like really noticing as we were going through it. Like
that's
that.
Cool.
Yeah.
What about the illustrations? Who did the illustrations?
Yeah, that was Connor Henley, who's one of the other guys in the Sherwood Fellows team. He was just, we would get together and we would sketch it out. It was kind of like doing storyboards for a film, which is something we would do a lot for commercials and stuff, but then he would actually color them in. So
that's awesome.
Yeah.
It's beautiful. So what's the website?
Yeah. The website is beaglesandthestarstone.com. Nice. If you want to check it out and get one and, do a reading with your children.
And then take us to the Lion and the Lamb or Lion and Lamb book club.
Yes. The Lion and the Lamb is Jesus. And slightly beneath Jesus is this book club. As part of the whole kind of movement towards, families, I joined up with a company, called Catholic Ventures that actually sort of brought in, Catholic creatives into the fold during the pandemic, and they decided to fund it and all of that. So while I was getting to know them through that sale, we decided to work together on launching some new products. And one of them is this Catholic Kids Book Club that's just wholesome books for Catholic families based on ages.
That's
and
cool.
You can also get Beacle and the Starstone through subscribing for this book club. But it comes along with these. One of the things we did with Beacle that was really interesting was we made this experience box that had discussion questions for parents and these other sort of experiential goodies that would come with it. And everything that we heard about it from parents that used it was like, oh, this was so awesome. You know, we made it so much more immersive and really fun. And so anyway, we're like, what could we do to make that kind of experience more easily accessible? We decided to curate all these books, and one of the other things is just that it's so hard to find wholesome books now. You just have to you can't just go to the public library or like go to most like book lists that are out there online, because there's so much political kind of ideological indoctrination that's going on that
And it's not there. Like it's not like they say it in in the description, like, hey, on page 9, we threw this in there.
Yeah, there's like the boys kiss each other.
Yeah.
Like,
well, yeah, exactly.
What? Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's all this stuff that's just kind of like seeping in that I think parents are really nervous about. And to just know, okay, I'm going to get a steady stream of books that my kids are going to be really entertained with, but that are not going to be like driven ideologically in any direction, I think is really comforting and saves a lot of time.
So how often do you get the boxes?
Yeah, so they're quarterly kind of seasonal boxes, and that they have themes that go along with the seasons and help you to sort of create a more liturgical cycle in your own family with it.
Yeah.
And there will be 3 to 5 books for each box, depending on hardcover and how big they are and how much
Yeah. It's so interesting. Like, I'm seeing with my kids how important a lot of, like, fantasy is, because it, like, it bleeds over into everything else. So we watch a lot of the Avengers, and then Lord of the Rings we've kind of watched pretty much. And then I've read some of Lord of the Rings. And it's funny how, like contextually something will happen, and then it'll be related back to those stories. Mm-hmm. And I just think that's so cool. Like I forget sometimes how important it is, especially for younger kids, to have like the fantasies and the stories for their like ethical development or their moral development or virtues and stuff like that.
Yeah. It really is our like our underlying operating system. You mm-hmm. know, if you want to develop a kid's more sense of morality, like that, the operating system is the myths and stories and parables that you give them and feed them. And it's a lost art for us. I think one of the really sad things about the whole way that we're trying to drive ideological kind of messages and political messages into kids' brains is that like stories, those stories suck. They just are boring when you try to do that. But old, really like meaty kind of moral things that have to, that really are human, like those sorts of questions, that stories that deal with those things, the kids just like need them.
It's, yeah,
it's amazing.
So you're alluding a little bit to, what is it? Joseph Campbell and like Jung, you're like into that stuff, right?
Yeah. Super into it.
And so like, I don't know, for people that don't know that kind of stuff, which Campbell's like that all myths, kind of lead, like there's these archetypes and myths kind of, there's many different types of myths, but there's really kind of one or two. Am I saying this right? Like what was the,
I think ultimately all you need to know is that there are deep stories that have been passed down from generation to generation to generation in our history, as a race and as a species. And those stories have evolved along with us, and we've evolved along with them in such a way that they speak almost biologically to us. And these sorts of archetypes are, you know, there's the hero's journey that people talk about a lot. There's like this kind of Gandalf figure, if you will.
Yeah. These like are a mentor or sage. Yeah, and like
I think one of the things that's really amazing about, you know, Star Wars or Lord of the Rings is they've nailed these archetypal figures and have told stories that stay very true to those sort of archetypal morals, like the sort of kid from a country town who is uncommon, or every way he's a common person, but has an uncommon destiny, and then has to learn some sort of profound lessons about life in order to overcome the evil forces that would otherwise be oppressing his people. Like that is a journey that we see in so many different stories, but
and like the call to adventure,
these things. So if you basically, archetypal figures, archetypal symbols, archetypal stories are plugging into some of these deep, long-held, images and meanings and morals that have helped the human race to survive by teaching us virtues.
Yeah. How do you process that with, or what do you make of someone that looks, there's like two ways to look at that. One is that these things are all made up, or another one is like they're based in like an objective reality. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know. What do you make of that? Like, I think about that a lot. Like, are we making these things up because they're true, or are we making these things up because biologically it just happens to be that way? You know, like, I mean, as like a Christian, I want to believe that we are making that there are these archetypes because it's true, because there's something true there, that like every human person is called to an adventure, that there are sages we can look like. I don't know. Does that make sense? As opposed to some people, maybe a materialist view, like a scientific view, is like, well, this is just things we made up to kind of hold our social structure in order, and like just so that we don't rob each other, and we just collectively, like, I don't know, honor these virtues and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it is very clear that life prefers love and collaboration, like that somehow love as a force that works through even biology to overcome death and darkness and suffering. That is, it's a story that's so deeply built into the foundation of the world that regardless of whether the human species was here making things up, is very true.
Yeah.
It's just a truth. Like, you know, you even look at the structure of a cell, right? That you need this DNA that's entwined. And in order for, like, a cell to reproduce, it has to, well, yeah, it, the fact that a cell can reproduce is just an amazing thing,
yeah.
right? And in order to beat darkness and death, it doesn't become in and of itself something that is invulnerable or immortal. It passes its life on in some sort of, like, I'm giving myself to the next generation.
Yeah.
And yeah, this is all sort of amoral. It's not done consciously, but it's built into the very mechanisms of life.
Yeah.
And I think that if you zoom out, a lot of our stories, even the story of Christ, is very much like the story of that cell. It's like a story of self-gift in order to kind of feed the rest of the world and to bring it to life. And so anyway, I think that, yeah, I don't know if that's a good answer, but
no, that's great. I mean, when you start with when you started with this book, did you start with just the idea of a story, or did you start with the idea of a principle or moral that you were trying to write about?
Yeah, I started with a principle and a moral. I think that as a kid, I was really like, I would struggle a lot with Christianity feeling very dark.
Yeah.
And I think one of the struggles of my adulthood in general has been to let go of a shame-based, sort of discipline-heavy, sacrifice-based Catholic worldview.
Yeah.
And I think the parable of the pearl of great price or the treasure in the field is very interesting in that regard, because it's completely the opposite tonally. Like, it's this kind of playful prank on the world that Jesus is saying, this is what the kingdom of heaven is. It's all, every sacrifice that you make as a Christian is like the man who goes and knows that he's got this treasure buried in the field and that he's selling everything he has joyfully in order to get it, because it's going to be way better.
Yeah.
And that kind of playful way of approaching faith, I think, is something I aspire to, but also something that I want to correct in the way that I would raise my own children or influence nieces and nephews and godchildren. So that was kind of how I like approached it.
That's awesome. What was the biggest thing you learned? Have you written stories like this before? Like, do you write? I mean, I know you write poetry, but like, is this the first in this genre? Like, have you ever tried this before?
First in the genre, but it's all kind of the same. Like, even working on commercials or marketing campaigns, it really all is like, who am I speaking to? What am I trying to say to them? Mm. And then, like, what are the sort of, you know, story beats that show the struggle or the journey through that moral lesson?
Yeah.
And I think, yeah, it was a very harrowing experience, honestly, doing the editing and letting go of, like, the darlings. And really, ultimately, I was writing in the public library, finishing it, and there was a certain moment where I kind of, like, found the whole thread and the core of, like, what I was trying to say in the editing process. And I just started, like, weeping, sobbing uncontrollably, you know, like, this is something that's so deep to my heart and to my own experience. So, yeah,
Awesome. Not, I mean, maybe talk more about that, because not a lot of people, think that you write to just write down what you think, but there's this idea that you write to find out what you think, like the practice of writing. Like, you have a general idea of what you think, but when you write it down, you kind of discover what you think and believe.
Yeah. Or more deeply, you know, there's like a general sort of, I'm heading in this direction. I kind of have this idea. But then when you really get into it, you realize how, God uses the journey of art making and the creative process to really form you on the inside. It's kind of like what everybody says. It's like, if you want to really learn something, teach it. You can learn it this deep. And then when you actually have to create around it, you have to go down to like many, many, many levels below that.
Let's now transition, speaking of that, to the film, the feature film that you're, or describe it for people.
Yeah, so I'm working on a feature-length film about Maximilian Kolbe, toying around with some different titles, but The Passion of Kolbe is one, and the idea being that Kolbe, in his kind of final days, I've heard the story of Kolbe told many times where he makes this very heroic sacrifice, right? And he's called out into roll call. There's a prisoner that has escaped, and now they are condemning 10 men at random to die. And he trades his life for one of the other men who's condemned to death. And I think that's a really beautiful thing. But again, it almost feels a little bit like dour and dark. And I mean, of course, the whole story is dark, but just the fact of like heroism is me trading my life so that another man can live and I die so he can live. It's like, I don't know. Honestly, if that's Christianity, like, fuck that. So
Anthony coming in hot. We're freaking 40 minutes in and Anthony comes in hot. Wait, so say more. Hot? So the idea of like at needing to lay down your, or the idea that, hey, this is what Christianity is, kids. Like, you need to just die for other people.
Right, yeah. I think that that's, like, actually a really destructive thing to teach children.
Yeah.
That it somebody else's life is just much more valuable than your own life.
Yeah, yeah.
And I do think sacrifice is really important. But, again, going back to the parable of the pearl of great price, there's this, like, you are getting something beautiful out of it that you want more than that, than just the other person being alive.
So it's kind of like you're missing why that St. Maximilian Kolbe was focused on the pearl.
Yeah.
Like you're kind of missing that in like we just focus on the reality, like, or if you could tell the story in a way where it's like this guy needed to die, this other guy died for him, and then that was
it's just a trade. It's a one-to-one trade. Yeah, yeah. And there's not like a there's not profit.
Yeah. But like to St. Maximilian Kolbe, like maybe to stretch the analogy too far, but like to say Maximilian Kolbe, that action was selling everything to get the pearl, right?
In a way, but I think like describing what the pearl was is a really big part of what I'm hoping to do with this movie. In that, we have to recognize that Poland has always been a country that has been oppressed and invaded, and where the oppressors have actively tried to rip out the core identity of that. Kind of, which is Catholicism. They've been trying to rip that out of Poland for 1,000 years and more than that. So Kolbe is a very Polish person, and he's in this place where the Nazis are literally trying to rip the spirit and the soul out of Poland. Like, this is very early in the war. They've overcome everything very quickly. It looks like a completely unstoppable, destructive force that is going to win and going to overcome and become the new sort of empire, if you will. And the first thing that they're trying to do in Poland is to destroy the whole undergirding spirituality of the whole place, right? Like, Polish brotherhood is very deep and very strong. It's part of how they grit through everything. And so if you look at the way that they're punishing them or trying to deter them from escaping, it's like this one man escaped, and in doing so, he knew that he was condemning 10 of you to death. So they're saying, in a way, ultimately, all of you guys are out for yourselves. There is no real brotherhood in Poland left.
Yeah.
And when Kolbe steps out of line to kind of confront the commandant, what he's doing is this kind of like catalytic spiritual resistance against that lie that they are trying to bring into all, like, basically just like they're trying to destroy the whole worldview of the Polish people with very demonic lies. And so his act was an act that really was trying to restore the brotherhood of Poland. And when he stepped into the cell, then he was ministering to these men for 14 days. And if I was in that cell and I was in Auschwitz, I think that the first thing that I would have wanted to do, well, what would you have wanted to do?
If I was one of those guys.
Yeah, you're in the cell and
you know that you're just going to be there until you die.
Right.
The first thing I would do, man, establish a strong P corner. I don't know, man. I mean, I'm not sure. You know, I've thought so much about, I still remember, have a very vivid memory of the first time I heard this story from a priest telling the story in a homily. And I was a little kid and we were in Europe. We weren't in Poland, or maybe we were, I don't know. We were somewhere in Europe. I remember this priest telling a story, and I was just like enraptured by the story. Like, it just seemed so intense and so crazy. And I've thought a lot about, I don't know what I would do. Kyle, what would you do? First thing,
I think it's an impossible question because it's very easy to say in a warm podcast studio, I would do X, right? But the obvious aside of if I'm in the cell with Colby, I want to go to confession. I want to get that taken care of.
Oh, that's true. You know there's a priest. Oh, yeah, yeah. Okay, so, yeah, you know there's a priest. That probably would be definitely the first thing.
I'm knocking that out. And honestly, at that point, if I'm in Auschwitz, I'm ready to go, right? It doesn't matter if you're not ready or not. The clock is ticking. It's the death camp, right? And bearing extraordinary circumstances, you're gone. And one member of my family got out of there, and it's not, I don't think I'm going to make it too, statistically speaking. So I think I'd go to confession and just be ready to die.
Yeah, and like honestly,
which is very easy to say, for the record, it's very easy to say, oh, I wouldn't beg for my life when I'm here.
Yeah.
But
and honestly, to not get super dark, but I think I would just be like, man, most of this is going to be mental anguish as you just starve. And like, I mean, honestly, I'd probably try to just like, I mean, one, pray, but also just like meditate and mm-hmm. like trying to just like, this is going to be an extremely emotional and could get really, really bad. Like, cause you're in there with other people. It's not like you're just starving in a cell by yourself. Like this could get rough. And yeah. Like wanting to do everything in my power to like guard against like the emotional like deterioration, you right. know?
Yeah. I think that a lot of people, if they were really, really honest, would say like, if there was a way to take an out, I would just take the easiest off. Yeah. Like if I could commit suicide,
the thought would cross mine.
I know that there's no point, like I'm not going to be doing much for anybody by staying alive. I think that a lot of people would just try and commit suicide if they could.
Yeah.
And that clearly was what the Nazis were expecting and what they were pushing people to do. I mean, one of the ways that they would intro people into the, like, into Auschwitz itself would be like, hey, here's the electric fence. If you want to take an out at any point, go ahead and throw yourself against it and you'll die immediately. Jeez, that was like,
I didn't know that.
That was like, hey, welcome everybody. Here's the electric fence. You can kill yourself. Yeah. And people would do it regularly. So people would watch other people like run up and, you know, throw themselves on the electric fence and kill themselves. So they were really promoting like kill yourself, kill each other, every man for themselves, steal food from each other. Like they were trying to just completely destroy any sense of humanity that was present. So what Colby is doing is preserving the human soul of Poland and standing against that kind of oppressive spirit by ministering to these men. And if they were able, they survived, he survived 14 days, but the normal life expectancy in one of these cells of starvation would have been 2 or 3 days, right? Mm. So they're singing songs and hymns and anthems that are being heard by other people in the cells. And these cells are beginning to sing with them and it's becoming a routine. And so all of these people who are walking outside of this prison cell are now saying, like, it sounds like a chapel. It sounds like a place of prayer, which of course was outlawed in Auschwitz. So the only place where people were free to make a religious sort of pilgrimage or have a religious experience would have been within earshot of this, you know, this cell. So I think what they were doing was not just, what Colby was doing was not just saving this one man. He was saving like the soul of Poland and having a massive impact on all of the people who were in Auschwitz at the time.
Yeah. It's interesting that like the idea of the cell, like, you know, you're going to die, but that's not very much different than our lives. Like, I know I'm going to die. Like, I was just, as you're telling that story, I was like, man, that's really, it's almost like in a way, not to get theologically like inaccurate, but like in a way, like they all became priests in the sense that like what they were doing, like transformed this suffering and transformed this into something that was like changing the atmosphere of the place. And,
yeah.
But then I was like, but then immediately I'm like, well, we're all going to die. Like,
right.
Like, what is it about the imminence of the death as opposed to like, I know I'm going to die. Why? I don't know. It's strange.
I think it's a really good point because for me, that's been I go to this story to deal with my own fear of death and with my own fear of suffering. And I think that Colby's example is like, it is a modern Christian yeah, Christological story. It yeah. renders Christ's story in a way that's like in modern trappings to a way that I can really understand. Yeah. I think it's really beautiful.
Why was the life expectancy 2 to 3 days? Because I've gone 3 days without eating.
They didn't get water either.
Oh, okay.
So they would have had to really fight in some way to stay alive.
Gotcha. I was wondering if maybe like they just ended up like, I don't know, killing each other and stuff normally, or
that cannibalism was also a thing. Yeah.
I remember now that I actually have you visited the cell in the yeah, I remember.
Yeah, I just was there.
I remember being there. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That was pretty crazy. Kyle, did you get to go to Poland?
No, I never went to Austria.
It's worth it. It was pretty cool. There's a quote on the pitch deck that you shared with me, something about someone saying that the cell got turned into a cathedral.
Mm-hmm.
Who is that by? And like, what was the context?
There's a janitor who's really the eyewitness to all of it. Mm-hmm. He was also sort of a member, a prisoner of Auschwitz, but they would give, part of the whole thing was they gave all of them chores that helped to make each other's lives worse. You know what I mean? So there's this one janitor that was sort of taking care of the cell, and he would be present every time they would go in to take a body out. That kind of thing. And so he just had really beautiful things to share about the story.
Yeah. And then share some of the stuff that's unique about the film, because other Christian films have to have huge budgets because they're a period piece, but you have a little bit of a unique take on the set and the.
Yeah. So one of the reasons why I think we don't see many Catholic stories about saints coming out, which in and of itself is really, I think, a crippling thing for us, because media is so important. Like I was sharing before, stories really tell, like they become the underpinning way that we navigate the world. And if we don't have really good stories to share about our saints to our children, like we're impoverishing them of a sense of moral navigation. So anyway, the difficulty though is economic, that movies take a lot of money to make. And if we want to tell saint stories in particular, these are history pieces and period dramas. In Hollywood speak, that means expensive as hell.
Yeah.
Because you have to like recreate a whole world.
Yeah.
And all of these sets are huge. The costumes are expensive. You know, the sweeping thing over the town, it's like that one shot panning over the town is like $1 million or more. You know? Yeah.
There's going to be a lot of horses.
Right. Yeah. Involved. Yeah. Rent. Who do you rent horses from? Who do you rent like the, you know, the like 1920s car that's like driving down? Yeah. All that stuff. Yeah. It's very expensive. So I think that when I was thinking about how would I make a movie that was tellable, but that didn't cost like $16 million to make, I thought there's a lot of drama in Colby's story just inside of the conversations he's having with the other men that he's stuck inside the cell with. Like, what would they have been talking about for those 14 days?
Yeah.
And I honestly was like, wow, that I would watch that movie.
Yeah.
And,
yeah, yeah.
So the idea is this is sort of like Passion of the Christ meets 12 Angry Men, where, in a lot of ways, like life itself is on trial. Should we stay alive?
Pull up 12 Angry Men. What's remember
very,
that
very
movie?
Very famous movie.
Is this the one where they're, the jury?
Yeah. It's okay. Like a jury stuck in one room.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
There's just really high stakes because they have to decide whether or not this kid dies. And there's one man who's kind of saying, hey, let's not kill him. I think that he's innocent. And
wow, man. Yeah, there are a lot of like connections.
Breaks it down until all of them kind of come onto his side.
Yeah.
And so in this film, it's like Colby is the one man saying, let's not kill ourselves. Let's stay alive for the sake of the camp as long as we can.
Yeah.
And our lives can mean something still, even though we're in this like place of suffering. And eventually all of the men kind of come on board with him to this sort of spiritual resistance against the Nazis.
Did you do much research into this movie, or like, did this influence it much?
Oh,
or
yeah,
it just
for sure. I think after watching it many times, I thought, it's genius because you're getting to know men, you know, and it's super dramatic, but it's all in this very tight kind of claustrophobic, place. And all of that actually makes it even more interesting.
Yeah.
So, I think that personally, someone that enjoys really good conversations and group dynamics and things like that. Like, I think it's really interesting to watch a group of people try and figure out a problem together. And so, yeah, movies like this really influenced me.
And it's an interesting constraint because, especially in a world where we have, like, Avengers and Marvel and there's so much CGI, what can you show and all this stuff, it's almost more impactful when you don't show something. It's almost more impactful, like you're like your imagination's having to kind of fill in what's happening outside the cell, what's happening in these other places, like people are talking about things. There's almost more terror and more, like, I don't know, there's like a bigger impact where you show less in some situations.
Yeah, for sure. There's definitely plenty of plays. I mean, Shakespeare is a good example of this, where like a lot of the battles are all happening off screen and the characters are really talking about them. But what's really beautiful about that is that like when you're hearing somebody tell the story of something that's happening outside, you're learning about the plot, but you're also getting to know the characters.
Yeah.
It's like where story happens is... Yeah. How does a person transform when they make certain decisions and take certain risks towards either darkness or towards the light?
Yeah.
And I think those kinds of questions and those sorts of journeys can be brought even more into relief when you have a very simple set and it's not plot. It's like these people having to make these sorts of life and death decisions.
So how many total actors?
There's more scenes than that spot, but there's 10 men that get thrown in the cell. Okay. So there's 10 men plus the Nazi commandant and the janitor and a few sort of Roman soldiers, if you will, kind of thing.
So what state do you already have actors and stuff picked out? Like, what stage of the process are you in?
No, we finished the script.
Oh, nice.
And
wow.
It's in development, meaning right now I'm pitching investors looking for people who kind of want to participate in funding the first sort of half. Well, 250K is what we need to actually get started shooting, and then another 250K for the marketing.
Yeah.
And so once we get the 250, then we'll start shooting, and hopefully that will be sometime in the spring or the summer.
Dang. So the script is like finalized?
Script is never final.
That's true.
Even when you're shooting, like the actors, at least in the way that I like to direct, the actors get to really know the characters and they get to say, I wouldn't say it this way, you know, and that actually can lend even more like, you know, organic naturalism to the script. But it's at a point now where it's shootable. Like, I think that if we shot it right now, it would be very successful. It's just there's probably more things to cut, more things to get, like to do more efficiently, perhaps whenever we get all the locations and we're like, oh, well, we don't have a British 1920s sort of like villa right next to a like concentration camp outside look. So we're going to have to like, you know, rewrite the scene in order to
To make it fit,
deal with what we have here, that kind of thing.
Yeah. So, Kyle, you had a question earlier.
I was say, what other movies inspired you? Right. Cause it's really easy to say like, we're going to make a movie like The Passion and 12 Angry Men, like two of the most influential movies ever. But I really like asking people, what are the things that inspire you that maybe weren't as like top 100 movies of all time, right? Because then you can get a little bit of a different picture of what you're interested in.
Have you seen 127 Hours?
Yeah, it's the arm movie, right?
Yeah, the arm movie. Exactly, where he has to cut off his own arm. Yeah, so he's like stuck in a small, small space, and he's sort of in a life or death survival kind of struggle.
Yeah.
And through that whole time, he's having flashbacks to memories as he gets more and more like deprived of hunger and sleep, like things become more surreal. And ultimately he has to like to overcome his really deepest character flaw, which is he loves being alone and doesn't care about being with people. Like he has to cut off his own arm in order to like go and be with people, I guess.
Yeah.
And it's a really powerful inner journey, but very, very simple movie with a simple set. So
yeah, that's like, there's one with Ryan Reynolds where he's buried in a coffin. And like the whole thing is just shot basically different angles of this coffin.
I haven't seen that one.
What's this called? Look this up, Kyle. Just Google Ryan Reynolds buried in a coffin.
Well, that sounds really good.
Yeah, it's called Buried, duh. I should have remembered that. Yeah, and then they talked about, like, scroll down just a little bit. So they made all these different interesting, like, like not exactly real sets for this coffin. So like sometimes the coffin feels like it's very, very deep. So they built like wood walls that go up really, really high, even though he's in the little size of a coffin, or they had to like create all these different sets to do these different types of angles, but it was pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Another one that I think is real interesting is, Clerks. You guys know Clerks, the movie?
Mm-mm, no.
So Clerks is, it's like Kevin Smith. You know who Kevin Smith is?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So it's like the movie that put him on the scene, right? It's, you know, one of the best comedy movies ever. And he shot it. It's in black and white, but it's from the 90s. And I, you know, I'd heard the movie's great, so I gave it a watch, and it is. It's spectacular. It essentially takes place almost entirely at this convenience store. This guy and his buddy are clerks, right? And it's, they go out, but it's pretty much only there. But it's black and white. And I liked the movie, and I had to reevaluate some things about myself. Because, like, man, am I a guy who likes black and white movies? Like, that's not good for me.
I have to reevaluate. Like,
I don't want to be that kind of guy.
My whole thing, my whole vibe, yeah.
Yeah.
But I felt better upon finding out that it wasn't an artistic choice as much as the budget for the movie. It was in the 90s, I think. So it was like $2,500. It was nothing. Maybe even less than that. And they couldn't afford to grade the colors. So they just shot it in black and white, not to be artsy, but just because it's easier, because you don't need to worry as much about your color grading, which makes some sense to me. But it was just spectacular. It sent this guy to lifetime fame. And I think that that's interesting, because I don't know anything about the backstory of 12 Angry Men, right? Was 12 Angry Men shot there because they had the idea? Or was it this natural sort of organic, I want to make a movie, I've got a great story, I don't have a lot of money? And I also don't know which one's cooler, because there's something mm-hmm. to be said for that grassroots spirit I love. There's also something cool to be said about, you know, I have the budget, but I'm still going to constrain myself, because that's what the art requires. I think it's all very interesting.
Well, it was written as a radio show first.
Really? Interesting.
So it was adapted, 12 Angry Men.
Oh, really?
So it was adapted from, like, a radio show to film.
Okay.
And, yeah, I think that sort of constrained it in
yeah.
that way.
Yeah,
that but it was, it took a really visionary director, I think, to be like, this could be a good movie. You
yeah.
know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah,
like,
yeah.
Like, oh, I mean, that's great for, I mean, there's so many things that it, everybody in film would say, you want really visual stuff. Like, you don't want, film is made for visual as a visual medium. You don't want a bunch of people on a stage talking. That is like a play or a radio show. This is a yeah. different thing. But I think that you can do so many things with film to really make that, to really show the interior life of a character through dialogue.
Yeah, it's almost like the more stuff you pull away, like the more things then you'll notice about the character. Like,
right.
if these characters were in these really elaborate sets and the set changed every time, it would almost be distracting. And then it really focuses, because I remember watching this and like a lot of it is just focused on a character, like really just thinking deeply and having emotions about like the conversation, you know?
Right, exactly.
This also makes me think, I don't know why I'm thinking of this, there's this very weird, I don't even know if it's a movie, I don't know what it is, but it's called Coffee and Cigarettes. Mm. Can you look this up, Kyle?
Sure.
On Wikipedia. It's called Coffee and Cigarettes. It's basically like five short scenes or vignettes, or I don't know what you'd call it, all involving coffee and cigarettes and like a few characters talking. And
short stories.
Yeah. I first came across, there's one where Tom Waits and Iggy Pop meet up in a diner, and it just makes no sense. It's like 5 minutes of them just kind of talking about nothing, and for whatever reason, it like grips me.
Mm-hmm.
It's like so. It like there's a, anyways. there's like parts in this that make
cuts.
Me laugh. Yeah, that make me laugh so hard, and I have no idea why. And it's just like, and then there's another one where Bill Murray and the Wu-Tang, Bill Murray is a waiter at a diner and he has coffee and he's meeting with two guys from the, two guys are dining there from the Wu-Tang Clan. And they're talking about like health benefits of, or the health, yeah. The dangers of caffeine and nicotine. It's so weird. It doesn't make any sense. And the conversation, and it's like, and it also, it's kind of the style, like older movies used to have much longer pauses between stuff.
Yeah.
And it's like that. It's slow.
Right.
And one of the fun, like there's just so, listening to Tom Waits look at Iggy Pop and go, you like the coffee at IHOP? And like making fun of him a little bit.
Yeah.
It's so awkward and so great.
Not to mention, that's RZA. That's a Steubenville native of Wu-Tang Clan fame, right?
Oh, really?
There.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, the Klan hung out in Steubenville for a little bit when they were first getting started. They moved to New York pretty quick, but they were around the area.
I didn't know that. So you're crowdfunding the movie?
I will be.
Okay.
There's sort of a combination of things in the beginning, it'll be sort of bigger philanthropists or distributors that want to participate. And then after that, we're going to do a crowdfunding campaign. That's just letting everybody that wants to participate and helping make it
and
to participate.
And like movies, is this just a nonprofit movie, or is this, is there like a business model behind trying to like you're, I guess, obviously trying to break even, or is that, or is it just like, no, I'm going to go to donors and they're going to pay, and it the making money on it, recouping money on it is not important? Or
yeah, movies are always a really risky investment, just in general, even for the biggest people in the industry.
Yeah.
Because they're expensive, and because the amount of like, hey, this one is going, it's very hard to predict which ones are going to land.
Yeah.
But that said, I think that for us to have Catholic stories that are being made that are like highly produced and done well, economically speaking, somebody has to go forward and prove like a model that that can work.
Okay.
And right now, the only person that I know of that has actually made money with a film is Mel Gibson, like a film that's religious. Mm. Since then, so many people have really like fallen on their faces trying to make things, and that's why nothing really happens. And if you can prove a model for a way to make money with a film, then you can make more of them. And so for me, I want not just to do this as a, I think it's a very deep, important story to tell, but I also want it to not just break even, but to become the kind of film that, you know, families watch, Catholic families watch as a part of their like Lenten meditations, mm-hmm. or, you know, that are going to be in every bookstore that's in Poland or whatever, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
So I think that is totally doable. And if that is done on a small $250,000 budget, then there will be clear movement. Like it's like digging a well, you know, like now there's going to be other investors and distributors or whatever. They're interested and see, oh, there's potential for really good artistic, like high art done for the Catholic world. Right now there's plenty of stuff that's being made for the Protestant world that, goes for those sort of sentiments. It's very like sentimental and, there's a very clear kind of bad guy, good guy thing. And that's great. I think that there's really great space for that. But I do think the Catholic world comes out for things that feel a little bit higher art. I don't know why, but, you know, maybe it's because we're all way overeducated and, you know, like just all liberal arts majors, like smoking tobacco and criticizing the great literature of the past. So we're all kind of like a little uppity when it comes to like our, you know, story preferences.
Yeah.
So anyway, I think that things that have that kind of character depth haven't really been made much.
Yeah.
Father Stu is a good example of something that's like trying to do something a little bit more edgy and interesting. Same with 8 Beats, which we did as short films. But yeah, this, I think I really want to make both a commercial and a spiritual success.
Is Father Stu would be a spiritual or a religious movie, but would you categorize that in the same place that you'd put like The Passion and
I think that it splits the difference between that and like some of the more evangelical stuff that's going out.
Yeah.
I think it, cause it
is
it
well. Is it a religious, I don't even know the terms, but like, are the people making Father Stu, is that coming from a Catholic organization or is it just a secular organization?
Yeah. It's definitely, it's from Marky Mark, who's Catholic. And
no. What I mean is what was that movie about the Cristeros War?
Mm-hmm. Viva Cristo Rey, that one?
Yeah, yeah. What was it called?
Viva Cristo Rey.
Yeah, like that was like a Catholic film company, right? That produced it?
I actually don't know much about the genesis of that one.
Okay.
It was Mel Gibson's wife did the Father Stu movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But like, gotcha.
Girlfriend, who she has a kid with him.
So would your film be in like theaters, like theaters?
Yeah, we would do a release, like a theatrical release, and then part of the way that the Kickstarter campaign will like funnel into that is that what these kinds of stories need is a grassroots sort of movement under them, groundswell, where people in a city are like, we're going to fill a theater. We're taking that on. We're going to be kind of like a street team. And we'll like rent out the theater. We'll take on the like sort of physical like burden of that. And then we're going to go and like invite, you know, the whole city out to that showing. So you build a network of those things all happening in different cities over the course of like, you know, a week or so.
Yeah.
And when you have that, this is another way that the movie industry works, that opening weekend is when all of the other theaters decide if they're going to take the, you know, to show it again. So the success of a movie has so much to do with opening weekend. And I think we Catholics are very slow to stories and things like we're like, you know, I'll watch that, you know, 3 months in after somebody tells me that it's worth watching or whatever. Yeah. It's hard to kind of, but you have to get that first kind of impact in order to have a movie sort of catch a wave and then go out to kind of the bigger audience of the secular world. So that would be how we would hope to make that happen.
We would do, I mean, we should do it in Grapevine. If you guys, if there's some way for me to help us rent out, I've always wanted to do something at this theater on Main Street.
Oh yeah, dude.
I would 1,000%, like I'm not joking, like 1,000%.
Yeah.
Like wherever I need to sign up where I can like, we'll film it there. Or like show it there or whatever.
Yeah.
Like I would 100% do it.
That's awesome, man. Yeah.
That'd be super fun. Yeah. That'd be really fun.
Yeah. Everybody will come out crying. You know, that's how it is. But
Kyle, anything else? Do you have questions? Oh, our recommendations this week?
Yeah. We got to do the
explain to Anthony.
So the way the recommendations work, Anthony, is that every episode we give a recommendation. So it can be anything. Mine are pretty structured. I do an album, a movie, and a TV show every week. I'm going to run out of TV shows soon, but we're doing our best. But it can be as simple as a piece of media you really liked. It can be a thing you do, an activity, whatever you want. So I'll lead
you go first, Kyle. This is what we do at the end of the episode.
Yeah, I'll lead off for music, the Rites of Spring self-titled album from 85, one of the real early great emo albums. I think it holds up super well. It's not really screamo, but it kind of came out of that emotional hardcore to DC. Really, really cool. Movies, Charlie Bartlett, it's this 07 movie. It's got a younger Downey Jr. and this guy Anton Yelchin. He's like a kid who becomes a therapist at his new school, new kid in town, a lot of those tropes. Really fun movie. Downey Jr. plays his like angry principal. He's hilarious in it. And then for shows, Silicon Valley. I think it can be a little repetitive at time. A lot of the seasons feel similar, but overall the core is very funny, especially if you have any interest in the tech scene in any way. Even if you're like, I don't know how to code. I don't want to know how to code, but I like to read the tech section of the newspaper. Yeah, you'll get the jokes.
I've watched a few episodes of Silicon Valley. It's
very
good.
Very, it can be very crass at time, especially early on. There's like a satanic episode that I kind of skipped, but definitely take the highs and the lows.
My rec is going to be to go to YouTube and search Coffee and Cigarettes, Tom Waits, and you can watch it for free, just like that one vignette or whatever it is. That's going to be my recommendation, is like, just go somewhere quiet and watch that. And then comment on this video, like how weird you found it or if you enjoyed it.
That sounds really fun. Mine will be, if you are a godparent and you have that little like Catholic guilt going on because you're not keeping up with the responsibilities, you know, perfectly, the Lion and Lamb Book Club is absolutely a fantastic godparent
perfect
gift.
Is there a link or a URL for that?
Just go to catholic.store and you'll see a banner at the top that sort of introduces it.
What about the Colby film? Where can people go to follow along with that? Or
it is
nowhere yet.
There is nowhere online that this is like really early, you know.
Okay. So friend request Anthony on Facebook.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, check me out on Instagram at the Dambro. No, if you're interested in that, honestly, social media is the way to get in touch with me.
So what year are you estimating that this would come out?
2024.
Okay.
In like during Lent.
Cool.
Yeah.
Awesome. Anything else you want to share with our massive audience?
Wow. Grateful to be here. Sometimes I feel like, you know, a little bit of a split personality. I think, today there's like a little bit of in and out. I was feeling kind of different in the first part of the interview.
I'll be honest. The first part of the interview or the first part of the episode, it felt a little touch and go a little bit, but yeah. I think we really got to a good
that
spot.
Early bathroom break, you could see on one of the shots he's standing up. It's like, we got to go pee before the show.
Oh, yeah, that's true. That's true. That's true.
That's what Edmund always tells me, and I never remember.
Yeah. All right, everyone. Thanks for watching this episode of the show. Go to drinkstudiocoffee.com to get all your coffee that you need to pretend you're working in a studio. Bye.
That's good, man. That's fun.
4, 3, 2, 1.
That was fun.
Booster ignition and liftoff of Discovery.
You're gonna die.
I'm Raymond Arroyo. We'll see you next time.